You say you did it. I say you didn't. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. I say you got lucky. You say I didn't try. So you say it all worked. I say not for me. You say I didn't try. I say you just don't see why. You say I didn't try. I ask, can't you cry? You ask, why should I? I ask as I sigh. Why can't you see it? If we exist as I, too few will make it if we are only I. Folks, that's the whole question in life is how much do we care about others and how much do we sacrifice a little bit to make our world a better place? We're going to talk about all kinds of issues on this show. This is the Lehigh Valley Discourse and WDIY, and I'm your host, Alan Jennings.
I'm back. I know this is the second time you're hearing from me this month. There may be another one yet coming. The station is very hyped about the election and giving me the opportunity to have more airtime to talk about the election. If you're paying any attention at all, you have to know that this election is the most important, certainly among the top five times when the United States was in a critical turning point where there was a presidential election. I would put Abe Lincoln, Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, and the Nixon re-election in 1972 is really critically important elections at a turning point time in American history. This one is, in my opinion, without doubt, the most important. A lot of people are saying that, but I wouldn't have to argue the same point. Most of us are fixated on the presidential election, but I hope you're paying attention to the so-called down-ballot races as well. Every one of the 435 members of the United States House of Representatives, it's up for election. One-third of the members of the United States Senate are in play this election. Currently, the White House is controlled by a reality TV star who's a Republican. The House is controlled by the Democrats, and the Senate is held by Republicans. You may not know this, but the agenda is controlled, I mean completely controlled, by the party in the majority. They decide what's on the agenda, what legislative proposals get a hearing, and which ones are tossed in the dusty closet somewhere. Senator Mitch McConnell, the guy that kind of looks like a cartoon character, is one of the most authoritarian congressional leaders in my 62 years of paying attention. The House of Representatives, though, is controlled by Democrats. The Speaker, of course, is Nancy Pelosi, an octogenarian grandmother who was raised in Baltimore but lives in and represents San Francisco. She's well known for her heavy hand. Tonight, I have an amazing lineup of guests. My leadoff, though, is my student intern from the summer of 2005. She is Molly Reynolds. Molly's been on my show before. She's probably half my age, and she has the job I wanted one day, which is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. I'm jealous. Molly, welcome.
Thanks, Alan. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you back. So I'd kind of like to just start out with what's new, but I wouldn't have to ask you anything else after that. I've got you for about 20 minutes. I want to make sure I take advantage of your availability. Molly is a Bethlehem native, daughter of Rachel and John Reynolds. The late John Reynolds was a political science professor, an ally and friend of mine. And I was lucky enough to have spent some time with Molly as a student intern. Her brother, by the way, will be running for mayor next year in the city of Bethlehem. That's Willie Reynolds. This is a very political family, a very, very smart group of young people. And Molly, I'm glad to have you. In a little bit, we're going to hear from the press secretary of the Lincoln Project. And then after that, Christine Todd Whitman, who is with a group called Republicans and Independents for Biden Coalition, just so you know who's coming up after you, Molly. So what do you think happens on Tuesday, November 3rd, from the perspective of what you do as a congressional expert and Brookings Fellow? What do you think happens on November 3rd?
Yeah, so I think it's worth spending just a moment talking about the House, but more of the time talking about the Senate, because yeah. I think that's where more interesting things are likely to happen. So in the House, obviously in 2018, so 2 years ago, Democrats made very large gains. They took back the majority in the House, and I expect them to probably expand their majority a little bit, pick up a couple more seats. There's not a ton of more room for them to grow their majority, if you will, at this point. They made most of the gains that the kind of current set of congressional districts facilitates. They made most of those gains in 2018, but I think there are, you know, a handful of districts around the country that could flip from Republican control to Democratic control in the House, and that obviously, you know, we'll have a different conversation going into the next congressional election when there will be new districts after this year's census. But most of what I'm watching in Congress in terms of the elections is in the Senate. And so there are six, to my mind, key Senate races where Democrats could pick up seats from Republicans. And then there's one seat, the seat held by Doug Jones in Alabama, that I think he's expected to lose. That was sort of a stars aligning moment for Democrats when he picked that seat up in a special election in 2017. But the key Senate races to watch that are currently held by Republicans that I think Democrats could pick up are the ones in Maine, in Arizona, in Colorado. Yep, so Susan Collins in Maine, Cory Gardner in Colorado, and Martha McSally in Arizona. And then sort of behind that are the seats in North Carolina, held by Tom Tillis, in Iowa, held by Joni Ernst, and in Montana, currently held by Steve Daines. There are six of those, and those are the ones that I'm really paying close attention to see if the Democrats will take a majority in the Senate after the election.
Before we get deeply into the Senate, and I agree with you, the Senate's where the action is there anything about the class of new Democrats that will be coming in that will make the House interesting in any way? Or is it going to be more diverse? Is it going to be more liberal? Is it going to be more environmentally oriented? Do you know anything about this incoming likely class?
I don't know too much about specific new members that we're looking at for this class, but I think going back 2 years to look at the class of 2018, there are a lot of exciting new members in that class who I do think will have kind of long-term effect on the institution. Even things like, you know, in Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Democratic Congressional Delegation now has, I believe it's four women in it, which it did not before. So thinking about those kinds of changes over time, obviously Representative Susan Wiles from the Lehigh Valley is one of them. But thinking about kind of what that kind of change means for the party over time is important.
Right. Okay, so let's go with the Senate. The person I'm most familiar with is Susan Collins. She's been kind of riding the fulcrum of politics for years. It's not an easy fulcrum to ride because it's moved further and further right. She is, of course, a Republican. She is representing the state of Maine. She, from my perspective, has been good on things like community action funding and low-income home energy assistance and other domestic programs when a lot of her party caucus members are not. How is she running? Is she running to her left to try to hedge the Democrats voting for their party person? Or is she moving right and trying to stir up more Republican Party base and to get them out? Do you know anything about how she's running?
So as best I can tell, she's trying to do all of the things and not succeeding terribly effectively. And some of that has to do with just the very polarized nature of the political parties, is that there are fewer and fewer voters who are kind of in the middle. That is not entirely a creation of the past 4 years, though I think it's probably accelerated since President Trump was elected. But trying to appeal to both the kinds of voters in Maine that have previously elected her and who might have previously split their tickets and have voted for, say, would be the kinds of folks who would vote for Biden, but then also vote for a Republican for Senate. And while also trying to appeal to people with whom the president is quite popular. And I think that for her, one of the things that has really been challenging is having to campaign after having supported Brett Kavanaugh in 2018. So, you know, we're in the middle of another brutal Supreme Court fight. But I think that was a real moment that really energized folks to come out against her. Her opponent, even before we knew who that person was going to be, raised a ton of money off that Kavanaugh position. And so I think that she's really demonstrating how hard it is in this moment to be someone who appeals to voters from both parties.
You didn't, in your list of vulnerable senators, mention Lindsey Graham. I sure wish he was vulnerable. Is that not in play anymore?
So I would say that's kind of in a third group behind the six that I listed. Again, it comes back to this issue of how many folks are there in South Carolina who are likely to say vote for President Trump, but not also vote for Lindsey Graham. And if we look at kind of electoral history across recent decades, we've seen increasing amounts of straight ticket voting. So fewer and fewer voters go to the polls now and vote for a presidential candidate of one party and a Senate or House candidate of the other party. That's not to say no one does, but the rates of that kind of ticket splitting have really gone down. Obviously, Jamie Harrison, who's running against Lindsey Graham in South Carolina, has raised an enormous amount of money. And so he certainly has the resources he needs in that state to mount a competitive campaign against Lindsey Graham. And obviously, who knows what could happen. But that's, I would say that's kind of in a third group of races that are a little bit behind the first two that I listed.
When I watch the president, which is a very difficult thing for me to do, I like better watching Alec Baldwin play the president. But what I hear these days sounds to me like it's downright seditionary. He's actively stoking the guys out there, with, you know, armed to the teeth. He's calling on those people to stand by. He's encouraging people to vote twice. And so I wonder, is there anything that Congress can do to check the control, I mean, the behavior of this president at this point? This is becoming an authoritarian country in many respects.
So I think there are a couple different kind of time frames to think about the answer to that question. So there's, can Congress do anything to change what the president is doing in the next 2 weeks before Election Day? Is there anything that Congress could do in the time after the election where we might see President Trump try to stoke mistrust in the results? And then kind of longer term, what could Congress do to try to make itself stronger against a future president?
Exactly.
I think in the very short term, there's nothing that we've seen over the past 4 years that suggests that President Trump is going to stop doing what he's been doing. I don't like to say that there's little that Congress can or will do in the next 2 weeks. I think in the period after the election, I do think that obviously we don't know what's going to happen on Election Day. I think there is some chance that the results are sort of convincing enough that there's really very little on which the president could try to make a stand and sow distrust in them. I think it's important to remember that we were just talking about these Senate races, that these same Republican senators who are in these races, and particularly if a couple of them sort of break for Republicans instead of for Democrats, not to mention all of the Republicans elected in the House, they need people to have faith in the elections that will send them back to Washington, right, as well as in the presidential election. So that's important to watch. But then longer term, I do think that we really need to have a conversation about Congress as an institution and what can it do to try and check the power of the president. And this is, again, a conversation that is not just about the Trump years, but the Trump years have really brought these issues into dark focus.
Right.
And figuring out, you know, what can Congress do to try and get some of its power back from an executive branch that has tried to do all manner of particularly racist policies through the executive branch. I think that that's a really important conversation as well.
So, you know, Trump has got to go away eventually, man. It's amazing to me how he has got the entire party by the throat and how people who have historically not been, you know, wimpy pushovers have suddenly become wimpy pushovers. And I just wonder, you know, at some point, members of the Republican side are going to have to extricate themselves from the kind of grip of Donald Trump and the legacy of Donald Trump. I mean, do you think that's going to happen, or do you think they're stuck on that position? I mean, I don't see how even Republicans can continue to be in his camp.
So I am of the mind that there are certain trends in the Republican Party that were perhaps accelerated by the election of President Trump, but a lot of what we're experiencing with the contemporary Republican Party predates Trump, particularly I'll come back to the Supreme Court and the real push to expand conservative influence in the judicial branch and what that means for corporate regulation and for generally trying to reduce the size of the federal government. I think this is also true about a lot of the rhetoric around race that we hear from the Republican Party at the moment. So there are certain elements of the modern and contemporary Republican Party that, again, predate the president. And people, a line folks use often is that President Trump says the quiet part loud. And I think there are a number of important ways in which that's really true about Republicans generally. In terms of Republicans trying to kind of separate themselves from the president, I actually think you've seen some folks try to start doing that. There was some audio that came out last week from Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska, where he said a number of things about the president that are, I think we're going to see more of that, particularly as the election approaches, if folks think that the president is going to lose, and then after the election as well. And I think one thing that's important as we think about how to rebuild the strength of our democratic institutions is not letting Republicans who have supported a number of these policies from the administration, not letting them try to get that distance and really sort of hold Republican office holders accountable for the support that they've given to the president over time.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. My guest currently is Molly Reynolds, a Bethlehem product, a graduate of Liberty High School, and currently a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute, specializing in Congress. Molly, we're going to run out of time shortly. The partisanship, the hyper-partisanship that has crippled Washington and the United States Congress in particular, does this ever get righted? Do you see it getting righted?
So I think for it to get righted, we really have to change the incentives that members of Congress face. And right now, particularly on the Republican side, the incentives are to kind of back the president and to try to do things that are going to get them reelected. And so, again, I think as we move forward, we need to think about how to really revitalize a healthier two-party system. There are some folks who think that this will take changes to the way that we elect members of Congress. So, you know, thinking about, we were talking about Susan Collins before, Maine, the state of Maine uses something called ranked choice voting, which has become a popular idea for trying to depolarize the parties. I don't think there is a magic bullet, but I do think that as we move forward, in order for members of Congress to change their behavior, we really have to change the incentives that they face.
Molly Reynolds, Senior Fellow, Brookings Institution. That's such a cool title, Molly. I'm so damn jealous of you. It was great to have you on the show. I'm sure I'll be wanting you to come back in the months ahead. And it'll be an interesting day, November 3rd and November 4th.
It was great to be here. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to come back anytime.
Thank you, Molly. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. We're going to take a short break. I hope you come back. We're going to be talking to the press secretary for the Lincoln Project. Stay with us. Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. This is WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. And we're talking politics. We're talking about the election. So now I've got on the show, I've got R.C. DeMezzo, who is the press secretary of the Lincoln Project. R.C., welcome.
Thank you for having us, Alan.
And I also have Jeff Timmer. Jeff Timmer is a senior advisor for the Lincoln Project. He's also the co-founder of Republicans and Independents for Biden, and the former executive director of the Michigan Republican Party. So the amazing thing here is the breakdown of what I just have considered to be extraordinary discipline of the Republican Party, that there are Republicans, you know, that are willing to go out on a limb and say, this guy's crazy. We can't have this in our democracy. Let's start with either of you explaining the Lincoln Project. I mean, I think we have smart listeners. I think a lot of people are familiar with it because you've been so effective. But go ahead. Tell us about the project.
The Lincoln Project was formed to reach out and communicate and persuade Republicans or center-right voters who are disaffected with Trump, who are horrified at his trampling of traditional Republicanism, traditional conservatism, and his trampling of the rule of law. And there are a number of Republicans, counting in the millions across the country, who are willing and open to voting for another candidate and are willing to support Joe Biden. And that's who our campaign has been targeted at.
You guys seem to have raised a ton of money because the ads are pretty ubiquitous. You must be getting a lot of support from people on the other side of the aisle, too, right? I mean, who want to see Republicans kind of break down, right? I mean, that's going to be a motive, isn't it?
The political alliances and coalitions are a transient thing, somewhat transactional in nature. Now we have the same, well, I say right now we have a common enemy. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. And, you know, we have not become Democrats. We are former Republicans. Some still call themselves Republicans. We have policy disagreements with Democrats, but we're engaged in a fight that's much bigger than a fight over what the marginal tax rate should be. We're fighting over the fundamental issues of right and wrong and the rule of law. And so we're willing to set aside those policy differences and look forward to engaging in the arena of ideas and policy at a different day once we can put our broken republic back together.
I consider it to be heroically patriotic what you've done. I mean, I don't know that there are a lot of people on out there who would abandon the ranks in order to stand up for what's right because of such an aberration that we have in the White House. And so I wonder, what do you think the process will be, assuming Biden wins, in, you know, the kind of re-education of the people who splintered off? I mean, do you expect to be back and getting paid to be a Republican operative again when this is over?
I don't think necessarily. Our politics isn't going to revert back to the pre-2016 more quaint disagreements between Republicans and Democrats. The Republican Party has been Trumpified right down to the precinct level, and it's going to take some time for the cancer that's worked its way into the politics of the Republican Party to work its way out. There are certainly those among us who think that's a fight worth having. There are others who think the fight should just be, start a new party. But first, before any of those discussions can be had, we have a monumental task before us in 2 weeks, and that's making sure that Trump is defeated. And then we can set about defeating Trumpism.
There's part of me that says, where in the world are you finding uncommitted voters? Because this is such a stark contrast. But what I think is happening is that diehard Republicans, like I'm sure you, are so appalled. The only question is, can they vote for Joe Biden? They can't vote for Donald Trump because they're so disgusted. But will that translate into a vote for Biden? Am I right? Is that where you're finding the converts?
Sure, Alan. You know, I think that's right. And you know, much of our strategy these last months in the campaign, at least since Joe Biden has become the presumptive nominee and then the nominee, has been both, you know, highlighting his differences with Donald Trump, but also making sure folks know that Joe Biden is somebody they can believe in, making sure that they know his record, making sure they know that he's a man of decency, that he's somebody that they can be proud of in the White House. And that's something that, you know, voters across both sides of the aisle can agree that pride in the Oval Office has been something that's sorely lacking in the last 4 years. So you'll notice in some of our ads that have gone up around the country and around Pennsylvania that there are positive spots around Biden and there are negative spots about Donald Trump. And we're proud to do both.
I run a community action agency here in the Lehigh Valley, and I've been doing this work for 40 years. I've never seen anything like this. But I've also followed Joe Biden over, you know, the better part of his 47 years. And I've always thought of Joe Biden as almost a Republican. I mean, he really has a fairly moderate voting record for a Democrat, and especially by today's standards, I think. Is he less of a threat and therefore easier to sell?
That's funny because, you know, the Trump campaign is trying to paint Joe Biden both as, you know, a basement dweller who can't string sentences together, but also the leader of the left wing and a socialist radical.
Right.
And, you know, they can't have both. And frankly, they can't have either. Folks know Joe Biden. They know who he is. They know what he stands for. They know that he's somebody that places a high value on bipartisanship. His Senate record speaks to that. His time in the White House speaks to that. His rhetoric on the campaign trail speaks to that. And so Joe Biden knows, and so do the Lincoln Project, that to win this election, we're going to need folks of all political stripes to come together. And that's exactly what he's doing. And you see it in his slogan. I mean, rebuild the soul of the nation. And I think, you know, that is what his campaign is centered about. And that's kind of what the Lincoln Project has been centered about.
I'll add that the Republicans have spent the last two political generations talking about how character counts, how character matters. And as soon as somebody with an absence of character like Donald Trump comes in, we found out that that was all a lie, that it simply became the ends justify any means whatsoever. That's where Biden comes in, because even if you have disagreements on how to solve a problem, how to what policy direction to take to get to the answer, you know that you can sit and have a reasonable discussion and debate and compromise and trust what he's going to, if he gives his word, you can trust that it will be good. And that's something that's completely lacking in the White House right now.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. We are talking politics with Jeff Timmer, who is a senior advisor to the Lincoln Project and co-founder of Republicans and Independents for Joe Biden, and also R.C. DeMezzo, who is the press secretary for the Lincoln Project. I consider ourselves to be very fortunate to have him here. Obviously, this is because Pennsylvania is a key swing state, and the Lehigh Valley is a lot of the reason why it's such a swing state, and because there are a lot, I mean, you know, we've got Trump country up in northern Northampton County. So we're fortunate to have them both on the show. Do you have a profile? I mean, who are the people who haven't made a decision on who they're voting for? What do they look like?
A lot has been written this election cycle about the last election, and a lot of the news stories are chasing the last election. There's been a lot of talk about the suburban women. And what that typically refers to are college-educated white women that Trump won narrowly 4 years ago. And while there's certainly a target and a key demographic in this election, the 2018 election showed there was a fairly seismic realignment among college white female voters. And you could almost, instead of behavioral Republicans or independent-leaning Republicans, they are now fairly reliable Democrats as a group. And the one of the targets, one of the stories I think that will be written about this election is the college-educated white men who are deserting Trump in droves. And you see that in states like Pennsylvania, like Michigan, Ohio, and across the Sun Belt, Arizona, Georgia, Texas, North Carolina, and Florida. That's where the battleground in this election has shifted. When you now have Joe Biden more likely to win Georgia and Texas than Donald Trump is to win Michigan or Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing thing. But to be honest with you, I'm amazed that it isn't 70-30, because I can't imagine how people can find this stuff acceptable. And Jeff, you're from Michigan. I've been appalled at what I've been watching up there. I mean, you know, Michigan's a great state. I don't have any kind of issues with it. But, you know, the rallies where the guys showed up with their weapons, the attempt or the broken up plan to kidnap the governor, for God's sakes.
And, kidnap and murder, yeah.
This is crazy stuff. This is, does that worry you about Michigan? I mean, is that like going on in every state in the country?
Well, that's what worries me. It's been highly publicized in Michigan. And one thing you pointed out there, those folks that showed up at those protests months ago with their guns at the Capitol, some of them were the very same people who were arrested in this murder kidnap plot against the governor. So there's a direct line between those people. And I think there's a direct line between Trump's rhetoric and their actions. They are radicalized in the same way that ISIS fighters are.
When
Trump tweets Liberate Michigan, and when he tells the Proud Boys to stand back and stand by, these crazies hear something else than sane people do. And what scares me is I don't think it's isolated to Michigan or anywhere. I think that these people represent many others that we're not aware of right now. And that's the scary thing, because these guys were clumsy and stupid in their plotting and were discovered by law enforcement and intel, and the plan was thwarted. But how many others are out there acting as lone wolves who we don't know about, who might be successful in carrying out their plans to harm or kill people? And that's what scares me.
I don't want to put myself in too much of a spot with you on the Republican Party, but you know, I have a lot of Republican friends, and I vote Republican fairly often. I'm a Democrat by registration. I'm not a partisan. I'm comfortable in both places. These are good people, my Republican friends. They care about their community. They're engaged. They're generous in their philanthropic support. When they get together, though, and come together as a party, you get the Mitch McConnell mentality, which is, dug in, nasty. I mean, who took the Republican Party from us and gave us this party that we've got now? I don't get it.
I think we can look back over the last decade with the rise of the Tea Party and the kind of the move of the Republican Party toward a more vocal and energized extreme element. And not that everybody engaged in that meets that criteria, but what it seemed to do was empower some folks who had lived on the fringe, who had whether it's white nationalist views, whether it's extreme gun views like some of these folks in Michigan, it empowered them to become more vocal, become more visible. And I think we were maybe trending in a direction we didn't realize until Trump came along in 2015 and 16 and since, and has served kind of as a spark, as a catalyst to accelerate the move toward extremism, an element that was always there. But when I ran the party in Michigan, we didn't give those folks a microphone at our convention. We didn't empower them and give them a platform the way the party is embracing them now. And that's what's astounding to me.
Yeah.
And Alan, to your point, like you said, not all Republican voters identify with Donald Trump or with, even the Tea Party. And so that's a core group of folks that we're trying to identify. We're not out to make people feel bad for voting for Donald Trump 4 years ago. He made promises. He made promises that he would make life better for those folks, and he didn't deliver. And that's the message we have for voters, is that he is not who he said he was. He has not done for you and for your family what he said he would, and he has, turned the Oval Office into a circus. And so it's okay to have voted for him 4 years ago, but it's not okay to do it again.
Could you ever have imagined that I think, if you're paying attention, you had to be curious about whether a reality TV star who's a terrible businessman could make a good president. When we originally opposed Donald Trump, it was a policy-oriented kind of opposition. But did you ever imagine that the very notion of our democracy would be threatened by this guy's behavior? I mean, he's openly calling for essentially civil war.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to imagine. It's a hard thing to deal with. He is, in many ways, a vessel for a lot of bad actors in and around our democratic system. His singular motive is what's good for me, what's good for Donald Trump. But the folks around him, their motives are much more sinister. And so, the fact that he has allowed himself to become a puppet of the radical right just speaks to the real danger we're in and the real need to elect somebody with integrity to the Oval Office.
So who are the people behind the Lincoln Project? I know, Jeff, you're the senior advisor, but I know Steve Schmidt was one of the few names that I knew. Who are the people who put together the Lincoln Project?
Well, it's Steve Schmidt, who comes from the John McCain campaign, most notably, as well as John Weaver, who also came from the John McCain presidential campaigns, the 2000 Straight Talk Express that nearly derailed George W. Bush was the brainchild of John Weaver. Rick Wilson, who's a longtime ad man for the Republicans and author now of a couple of best-selling books, Everything Trump Touches Dies and Running Against the Devil. And there's Reed Galen, a longtime Republican and now independent operative. Mike Madrid, who directed the California Republican Party. Jennifer Horn from the New Hampshire Republican Party. And Ron Steslow, who is one of the top digital operatives in the country. Just a tremendous amount of campaign talent and really represent the success that the Republicans had at the ballot box, not just at the presidential level over the last 30 or 40 years, but winning governorships and U.S. Senate races and congressional races in the hundreds across the country. Folks like Stuart Stevens joined the Lincoln Project. Michael Steele, the former chairman of the Republican National Committee. The list goes on and on. Folks that good Republicans who are willing to stand up for the ideals that they represented when they were in office, when they ran party operations. And I do think, going back to what I said earlier about the rise of the Tea Party and Trumpists, that what R.C. said was right. most people involved in this process, most Republicans in office, I think, are good people and are decent people, and will be part of the coalition of the sane when it comes to rebuilding a strong center-right faction and party that our politics in America demands. We have to have a center-left, center-right viable party. That's the way American politics has operated for more than 200 years.
Jeff Timmer, you're going to stick around for the final segment of the show when Governor Christine Todd Whitman joins us. I want to let R.C. DiMezzo go, and we're going to take a short break. Jeff, stick around, and we'll be back with you on the backside of the break. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm Alan Jennings, your host. Welcome back. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. This is WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I am honored. You know I'm a liberal Democrat, but I am honored that we have Christine Todd Whitman on the air. That should be a familiar name to people in Lehigh Valley since she was the governor of our neighboring state in New Jersey for a number of years. Governor Christie, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Good to talk to our neighbors from Pennsylvania, always.
I still have Jeff Timmer on the phone. Jeff is the senior advisor to the Lincoln Project, but he is also a co-founder of Republicans and Independents for Biden, which is the effort that Christy is leading as the national chairwoman of the group. Christy, I'm sure you've got the kind of 30-second or one-minute elevator pitch.
Well, I mean, Republicans and Independents for Biden is about showing people that there are respected opinion leaders who are longtime Republicans or conservative leading independents who are saying this election is about more than Donald Trump and Joe Biden. It's about our country and the future of our country. And it's time now, and it's okay. These people who have been lifelong involvement, have had a lifelong involvement in politics, in government, in policymaking, are saying it's time to make this choice where you put your country ahead of your party. And it's okay for those who have never pulled a lever or checked a box for a Democrat to do it. Now is the time to do it, because this is about the future of our democracy.
When we were talking with Jeff earlier in the show, I called what you guys are doing heroically patriotic. I think that anybody who thought we were getting a little bit of an aberrant president 4 years ago today has got to be thoroughly appalled by, you know, what seems to me the unraveling of our democracy and the rule of law in our land. Are you alarmed by the prospect of this White House getting another 4 years?
I'm terrified. I mean, I honestly believe that another 4 years of an unbridled Donald Trump is going to, let me back up a little bit. He is not a Republican. He has established a personality of cult. Yeah. And when the Republicans didn't even bother to adopt a platform at this convention, this last convention, what they signaled was whatever Donald Trump says is what we believe. And that's not a viable party. And I happen to believe strongly in the two-party system being the best way for this country. And we don't have two parties now. We have a party, the Democrat Party, which has all the variety in it and the, you know, the left and the middle centrist and the more conservative members. And then you have the party of Trump. And that's not a healthy place for us to be in, both figuratively, literally and figuratively. If you look at the response of this administration to the coronavirus, it's been an abysmal failure of leadership.
Yeah, I mean, on every level, this has been a failure. But what amazes me the most, Christy, is that on everything, every item that you could check off that some candidate got toppled for in previous campaigns, this president has done and has gotten away with it. You know, corruption, personal enrichment, lying, women, and it goes on and on and on. How do you explain powerful people like Mitch McConnell becoming so captive to this aberration? This is not, I agree with you, he's not a Republican. How do you explain the loyalty?
We have to understand that we have a Trump presidency because we failed as the American people in the sense that for too long, we didn't take our responsibilities in our democracy very seriously.
I agree completely.
And we didn't bother to vote.
Yep.
We were having voter turnouts in primaries of 10, 12%. Well, that means you have the most partisan who tend to be on tending toward the extremes of their various parties, choosing the candidates for the fall. So when we got to the November elections, when you had about a 34% turnout, when Congress was at the top of the ticket, people were saying, I don't, a pox on both your houses. I don't like either candidate. And they didn't vote. And so Congress became so marginalized in the sense that the split between the two parties grew greater and greater. Then they couldn't work together. And they weren't doing what we wanted as the American people. People felt that the Congress wasn't responding to them. They didn't think that Congress cared, that they weren't tackling the big issues. So they got frustrated and they said, the heck with it. We want someone who's going to turn this thing upside down and give us some feeling that there's hope. And I understand that. But now they have to see that, in fact, what they have gotten, because so many of them wanted it turned upside down. Well, this man has turned it upside down, but not in a good way. And that's the key here. He's not what I don't believe most Americans want. He's not who we are, a nasty misogynist who is basically a bully out of the White House. That's not who Americans are or what they really wanted. I know how we got here, but now it's time to say, okay, we made a mistake.
Alan, I think that's why you're seeing such an unprecedented outpouring of leading Republicans, governors, senators, congressmen, state legislators, party leaders. The number in the hundreds, very prominent names who have come out and said, don't vote for the guy from our party, vote for the other guy. And that's unprecedented in American history. It really is.
I have got good relationships with almost all of the electeds in Lehigh Valley. I work at it. But I've talked to several state legislators who are Republicans who have told me privately they don't intend to vote for the president either. So as this unfolds, Christy, what do you see as your future in the party? Do you see yourself being ostracized because of the courage you've shown on this issue, or do you see yourself as being welcomed for being a true American, a patriotic American?
I'm not worried about either of those, frankly. I'm more worried about the future of the party, the two-party system, because, as I said before, I believe that's the best way for this country to function. If we had a multi-party system, the disparity would just be too great in trying to coordinate between the various levels of government that we have in the United States. And the most important thing, so much is going to depend on the turnout in this election and how it goes. If the president wins, if he just wins, not strong, but the president wins, then my part of the party is no longer really the name Republican, because he claims that, even though he's not a Republican, will be Trump. And that means that those of us who are not there will have to think about how do we come back and how do we actually present the American people with a kind of centrist approach to issues that they really want, which is where people are, to get problems solved, not to have everything just be partisan. Mm-hmm. There's policy in here that needs to be made. Our country desperately needs it. And so we have got to focus on that, is my belief. If Joe Biden wins, then that's a whole different ballgame, and the Republicans will have 4 years in which they can reset themselves, because Joe Biden will be a stable, he's a decent man, he's a strong man, he's a stable man. He will bring some certainty into how we govern. He will respect the rule of law and our military in a way that this president hasn't. He likes to use it, but he doesn't respect it. He will be the kind of president that will allow the country to get back on track, get back to normal, and that will allow the party to rethink how it's going to approach these issues.
So do you think other Republicans who have joined with you are going to have a place in the party, or do you think they end up as Democrats? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, again, I think if it's depending on how this election turns out, how the polls at the end of the day turn out, that's going to have a huge impact on that. But it's not so much about the party for me right now. It's about the country. That's the most important thing. And this disrespect for the rule of law, the viewing of the Constitution as an inconvenient document that gets in the way from time to time, the exploding of all our norms. I co-chaired with Preet Bharara a task force on the rule of law and democracy out of the Brennan Center at NYU. And we put forward, two major reports. It's a bipartisan, nonpartisan group of elected officials, former elected officials, people who've been in cabinets and had served in the government, a whole host of ways to try to get this country back on track and reforms that could be made. And I'm hopeful that we get a real discussion of those.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. The familiar voice on the line is former governor of New Jersey, Christine Todd Whitman. She was also the EPA administrator under George W., I think, right, Christine?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Was a noted moderate. And I remember, I think you were the great mentioner mentioned you as a Republican vice presidential candidate, I think when it was George W. running. And I kept thinking, as a liberal Democrat, oh, please don't make it her because she's going to bring a lot more votes to George W. Bush. So it's an honor to have you on this show. And I appreciate the fact that you were putting the needs of this and the future of this country out front, because not enough people do that. So we've got essentially crippled government. We don't have any ability to get anything done anymore, it seems, in the Congress. How do you see the nation healing if we don't have President Trump for a second term? Have you thought about that? Is there a way that this heals?
Oh, yes. I think I have ultimate faith in the American people and that we're not going to make this mistake again. But be that as it may, I really, really believe in Joe Biden. I mean, he has shown himself over the course of his years of service to this country that he is someone who reaches out across the aisle, who wants to get things done and knows how to do that, who is not a radical, but who is strong, and as I said before, a decent man, an honorable man, which I can't say for this president that we have today.
Yeah.
He is someone who will help heal the country. Now, it's not going to happen overnight, and, you know, the Trump supporters will be there, and most of them are very decent people, but you have those outliers who are frankly scary. Some of this militia that we see and the president's reaction to it has been inexcusable encourage it and to attack a governor someone who was threatened. And he'd known it for a time that she was being threatened and that the FBI was looking into there's a potential attack on her to kidnap her.
It's truly shocking.
And yet he still said horrible things about her, and he doesn't.
That still does.
Doesn't
they were
understand
chanting
that language.
Last night.
Yeah, that language, and particularly when the president uses the language, that has consequences.
Yeah,
language shapes behavior, and he just doesn't care. It's all about him, not about the country.
And his handling of the virus has been just as disastrous. Even though it's clear that he's lost an enormous number of votes by the sheer incompetence of leading the country out of this mess, he shows no sign of recognizing that he's got to change the message, you know, because he's just that arrogant.
No, it's just about him. He really doesn't care to sort of blow off the deaths of people, saying, well, you know, that happens, and only the old people get sick. No, it's not. And the other scary thing, there's so much we still don't know about this virus. Once you quote-unquote recover, have you really recovered? I mean, a lot of people are finding ongoing symptoms and problems, even young people. So we need to take this seriously, and to try to make wearing a mask into a political statement makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
I mean, it just doesn't.
When you were in your various roles, did you deal with then-Senator Joe Biden? I mean, I go back to him being in the United States House, then he goes to the Senate, then he becomes vice president. So he was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Did you deal with him as a neighboring state governor?
Not really, no.
He's really an old-school political kind of guy. You know, he's a back-slapping.
Right.
You know, let's get together and talk about it. You know, kind of that was the old days of the Congress. And you know, they criticize it as being a country club. I'll take the country club over the Civil War battlefield any day, you know.
It worked back then.
Yeah. Well, the way they do it now sure as hell isn't working. And,
no,
you know, I don't know what comes of this. If you were in Kentucky, would you vote for Mitch McConnell? Because he's been.
Oh, Lord, no.
Lockstep.
No way.
Yeah.
I mean, he has been such an enabler It's been really discouraging and frightening, because what he's done is used his power as the leader to force other Republicans to vote the party line every single time. It used to be people would get buys. You didn't have to vote party line on everything. Not everything was looked on as partisan. There was a difference. There were policy issues, and people were allowed to follow their conscience and vote policy. That doesn't happen anymore, and he's largely to blame.
The way he has actively undermined the integrity of this election, is your advice these days to encourage people to vote by mail or to go to the polls? Because what I'm thinking is, you know, going to the polls, you might wait in line. You might have to stand near somebody who's got the virus, but at least you know your vote, or you think your vote is going to count. I think there are a lot of people who are going to wonder whether their vote's going to get counted if they don't go to the polls. I mean, are you guiding people one way or another as an organization?
Not as an organization. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. The campaigns and the organizations have been encouraging people to vote early, to make a plan to vote, to make sure that they know that their vote is counted, whether that's an absentee vote, whether that's mailing it in, whether that's putting it in a drop box, whether that's handing it to an election clerk, or whether it's showing up to vote on election day. And so we're seeing such a tremendous rise in voter turnout, especially the early voting. The trajectory of the turnout projections are we're going to see a historic number of Americans vote this year. And I really don't think that Donald Trump can win a high turnout election.
That's Jeff Timmer, who is a senior advisor to the Lincoln Project and co-founder of Republicans and Independents for Biden. Also on the air with me, and we're running out of time, is former Governor Christine Todd Whitman from New Jersey. Christy, I want to give you about 30 seconds to make your pitch to tens of thousands of listeners in the swing region of Lehigh Valley in the swing state of Pennsylvania.
No, thank you. This election is about the future of our country, what kind of a country we're going to be. Will we continue to respect the rule of law? Will we continue to respect one another? This is time to put the country ahead of party. Donald Trump is not a Republican. He never really has been. And he's not been good for the country. If you look, we are less stable today. The coronavirus is spiraling out of control because he's refused to take it seriously and continues to try to make it a political statement. He spews falsehoods continuously and doesn't respect the rule of law. He is not representative of who and what we are as a nation. And so this time, this election and the Lincoln Project is showing the number of Republicans who are standing up and conservative independents who are standing up and saying it's okay this time, even if you've never voted for a Democrat, to pull that lever or check that box, because this is too important an election to sit out in the first place, however you vote, but it's too important an election to ignore and to think that you have to stay with your party.
Christine Todd Whitman, former governor of New Jersey, national chairwoman of Republicans and Independents for Biden Coalition, and Jeff Timmer, senior advisor to the Lincoln Project and co-founder of this coalition. Thanks to both of you for being with us. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. Thanks for being with us.